Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Ciara Mangan, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ciara, people might have seen you on the news this week. You were welcoming the decision by the Court of Appeal to uphold an 8-year prison sentence for your former work colleague, Shane Noonan, who raped you at a house party in 2013. And I think it's fair to say the last 12 years have given you, at huge cost to yourself, some unique insights into how society and justice work in this country. So you've kindly agreed to share some of those insights with us this morning. And obviously, given the nature of Ciara's story and what we're going to talk about, listener discretion would be advised for this conversation. Ciara, you said in your victim impact statement at the original trial, "I'll never be the same Ciara I was before the rape." Would you tell me a bit about that, Ciara? Before May 11th, 2013, what were you like? What was your life like?
My life was just a normal girl who was enjoying school. I would have been quite a studious person. I really wanted to do well in my Leaving Cert, and I enjoyed doing lots of, you know, extracurricular activities. So I played the fiddle and I did life-saving swim courses. I liked to study. I don't really have much shame about saying that. I just had great ambitions for my life, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do, like, but I knew that I would, you know, do pretty well in the Leaving Cert. But when I was raped, all of that ambition and drive and ability to live a normal life went out the window.
So I think you had turned 18, you had a part-time job in a fast food restaurant. That's how you came to be invited to this house party. You didn't really want to go to the party, did you?
No, I didn't. I was, you know, really wanted at this party. I was being quite heavily persuaded to go. I didn't feel comfortable going because I didn't understand, first of all, why I was wanted so much at this party, because the people, and I know I'm 30 years old now and I know how pathetic this sounds, but when you are 18, there is such things as like popular groups.
Yeah.
And, you know, peers are so important when you're, you know, a 17, 18 year old. So I didn't know why I was wanted so much at this party, because this group would have been popular, so to say. So I felt very nervous about going.
Okay,
I just didn't know who I would know there.
Yeah, okay. And then things kind of unraveled very quickly when you arrived at the party, after you arrived at the party, yeah.
Yeah, they did. My drinks were brought in. So I had brought 3 cans of Bulmers from my dad's garage, as you do.
Yeah.
And they were taken from me. So I had them in a Dunn's bag, and they went missing for about half an hour when we arrived to the party. I had positioned myself beside someone that I did know. And I was just eating away pizza and chicken goujons, and I was not really worried about where my drinks were at this stage. I was just trying to find my feet and feel a little bit less nervous. And I was just glad I could find someone to talk to. But then my Bulmers did get handed to me with a straw inside, and it was opened. So I began sipping on that then.
Okay. And what happened then?
So I finished that one can of Bulmers, and I still hadn't moved from the kitchen area. I was just kind of up by the oven, and I could see Shane Noonan. He had positioned himself on the opposite side of the kitchen. So he was on the adjacent wall, and he was just leaning up against the wall, and he was just watching me, like just watching. He'd go out side to the patio. It was a lovely evening. It was May 11th, and, you know, people were out in the patio just smoking, and, you know, it was about 8 o'clock in the evening. But he was just being a real loner. Looking back now, it was him waiting for his prey, which I said in my victim impact statement.
Okay. And look, you don't need to go into the details of anything here, but in the trial, Justice Eileen Creedon described what happened to you as cold, predatory, and premeditated. You were taken up to a bedroom and raped in quite a horrible manner. There is no other manner, but this was particularly
Violent.
violent.
It was on the bathroom floor.
Okay.
And I was left on the floor then. He walked out and left me there. And I say, and I count my blessings that I actually fell asleep. Well, sorry, I was unconscious for the remainder of the rape itself and the hours that followed. And thankfully, I spared myself quite a lot of horror, additional horror.
So you woke up on the floor in the bathroom and
No.
okay.
So they suspect it was sleeping tablets that were put in my drink, and I woke up in a bed. So someone had picked me up off the floor, and I woke up in a bed, covered in my own vomit, and I was choking on it. So I nearly died that night. They were all gone to the nightclub as well, so I was choking on it alone in this house by myself.
And what did you do then?
Well, obviously, I felt great relief because I was so ill from the tablets, and I was very, very confused. You know, I had lost 7 hours here, like completely. Just, I was basically dead. So I was very confused, and you know, my last memory of being awake was around 8:30. So this was 7 hours later. It was starting to get bright again. So I had lost the entire night. And people were starting to arrive back to the house then for the after party. I just couldn't find my bag. That was the problem. I needed to get home, get a taxi. but I couldn't find my bag and my phone. It did transpire that someone had texted to say to my mom that, "Hi, mom, I'm okay, don't worry about me." But it wasn't me that sent that text.
Okay. And your parents obviously had been very worried about where you were.
So they had actually, I'd really, you know, I just turned 18, so, and I'm the first of four children. So I asked them and I said, "Please, can you let me stay home alone this weekend? You know, I'm 18, I'm an adult now." And they were going to my cousin's communion in Navan. And I had outgrown that bouncy castle kind of phase in my life. And they said, "Yes, okay, fine. You know, we'll let you stay home for the first time on your own." And unfortunately, they regret that decision for the rest of their life now. But it's not their fault.
No. But I
No.
can imagine the what ifs for you and for
Yeah.
them and for everything. So you did go back to work. When did the rape songs begin at work?
So the rape comments started the minute I went in. So Shane Noonan was working there
The next
the
day.
next day. So he was completely then out of character. He was very ashamed, his head was down, he was very awkward. He knew, I knew, as we were kind of working together in the place, and then the rape songs started. So it was a particular song in the charts at the time, and they changed the words of it to "I'm Shane Noonan and I love raping women." That was the lyrics of this song.
And I think that attitude to it kind of made you doubt yourself too about what happened and how serious it was, did it?
I didn't really have the chance to process what had happened because it was immediately being made light of. You know, I was embarrassed. It was extremely shameful. I also was very confused, and I relied on other people to fill in the blanks for me. But I had to try and kind of put the pieces back together. And I think how I would describe it, and I think a lot of victims who also have been perhaps a victim of a drugged rape, is, you know, like the old cassettes that you put in to watch a video. Imagine taking out the black tape and then cutting off pieces and then putting it all back together again. It makes no sense.
Okay.
That is exactly what I tried to compute for 10 months.
And as we kind of alluded to earlier, you were a different person after that night. What changed for you? How did you change?
Well, obviously, I was very depressed. I used the silence in the tests in my school to do some rape processing. So I would hand up my tests completely empty. And that's kind of when my teacher started noticing that something was up. Something wasn't right with Kira. So they raised it with my parents to just say, because my leave insert was going to be in 3 months. And I wasn't applying myself whatsoever.
And you had been a really good student before this.
Yeah, I got basically all A's in my junior cert. And I think I would have got at least 550 in the leave insert.
Yeah. And I think back to that kind of happy, kind of innocent in a way kid that you were before that night, that girl was kind of snuffed out. Yeah,
she died.
Okay. How did it come about that you finally told your parents?
My sister Sinead is 3 years younger than me, and she was trying on her shoes to start working in the place that I was working in, and my mum came into the study room and saw me crying, and she asked me what was wrong, and I said, Sinead can't go into work tomorrow. My mum said, why? She's doing the induction. She's done the induction, sorry. She's trying on her shoes. She's starting tomorrow. I said, Mum, she can't go in because a man from there had sex with me while I was asleep.
And we don't often think enough probably about the families or anything. I think everything changed in that moment for your parents as well, did it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're never the same. Part of them died as well. Part of everyone died.
Yeah. Was it a help for you to have told them?
Yeah, a great relief. Really a great relief. You know, my mom just collapsed on the floor and just started really wailing for my dad. It was a Sunday and he was in the kitchen just peeling potatoes and preparing. And he just started running in like, who died, you know? And then my friend and my neighbour next door, she came in and then her husband took all of my siblings and their kids as well and rushed them over to the house next door. And we then called the guards.
So you were meantime trying to get on with your life. I suppose you have no choice in a way. You moved from Castlebar to Limerick to do business studies with German at the University of Limerick. But I think in that time, your mental health wasn't good. You were using drink and drugs to kind of numb yourself, was it?
Yes. To numb myself, I felt like if I was just asleep, none of this, I wouldn't feel the pain. So I would, you know, overtake tablets, drink myself into a coma, essentially. My friends in college actually got really worried about me because they hadn't seen me in a week. And I honestly did not leave my bed for an entire week. Yeah.
And when you'd come home at the weekends to Castlebar and holiday time and stuff like that, would you see Shane Noonan around the place?
Yeah. Yeah, I would. The amount of times my mum has picked me up from Paddy's night out or, you know, a birthday party or a night out with my friends, I could not, because he'd be there and he'd be really intimidating and, you know, he'd even like rev his car or like, you know, I didn't walk around my town for 10 years until he went to jail.
And after college, you moved to Berlin. Was that to escape? Yeah.
Yeah, that was to escape. Yeah, I needed to go away. I loved learning new languages. So I actually became fluent in German from living there for 6 years. And that was kind of an escape for me as well. I just really enjoyed, focusing on something. And I applied myself to this and But, you know, living in Germany, I also had a pretty hard time. I was going to counselling, but I had to stop going to counselling because the Gardaí would want, or the defence barristers would want my counselling records. And that process could take 3 months. Every time you go to one counselling session, it delays an upcoming trial for up to 3 months. So I had to stop because I needed this trial to be over. And if I was going to counselling, that was putting a delay on things. So I had to stop.
Really?
Yeah. So I did end up in a psychiatric hospital then in Germany as well.
For how long?
Not for long. Okay. But I...
Okay.
I did. Yeah.
Okay. So you made a statement to the Gardaí in 2017 and Shane Noonan was arrested, I think, the following year, 2018.
Yeah.
So did that news of his arrest mean a lot to you? Did it help?
Certainly did, because when you're arrested, it means that the Gardaí had significant evidence to start preparing a file for the DPP.
And then for a long time, I know it looked as if he would plead not guilty. And you would have had to give evidence in the trial then. How did you feel about that prospect?
Just terrifying. I think it would be the worst of all of the situations that you're in the justice system is being on that cross-examination stand, because we hear about how even, you know, yesterday, how a woman felt humiliated.
Yeah, yeah. And you would be cross-examined as a witness, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's what you are in that situation.
Yeah.
You were a witness. So then he changed his plea at the last minute. Was that a huge relief?
It was a relief, yes, of course, because I was getting sick in the bathroom of the victim's unit because I was told that I was going on the cross-examination stand in 5 minutes. So... he put in his guilty plea. It could not have been any later. Yeah.
Okay.
And you were just rushed into the barrister comes up and just tells you that there's been a guilty plea and that the judge is waiting downstairs. So you just kind of get rushed down to the courtroom. He's there. He says his guilty plea for the record and... then he was released on bail and we went back to the same street together, basically.
It's the same street in Castlebar?
Yes, I'm the Turla Road and he's the Turla Road. But he was released on bail after pleading guilty to a violent, predatory and premeditated rape because he was getting his affairs in order, like selling his car and preparing for prison.
Okay, so the sentencing hearing then, he was out for a few months between the guilty plea and the sentencing hearing.
Exactly.
You wrote a very powerful victim impact statement for that sentencing hearing. And I think I'd seen bits of it at the time, but I just read it all again yesterday. And actually, I was saying to you, every man and boy in the country should certainly have to read it. It should probably be on the school curriculum. What was it like reading that with him there in the room?
It's the first time that you feel like you don't have to fight for the truth. You feel like it's no longer my word against your word. It's you listen to me and you listen to what you did.
Okay. So some element of you taking back your power.
Yeah. You have the entire power. Yeah. Now, finally.
So, Miss Justice Eileen Creedon, as I said, she described the rape as cold, predatory and premeditated. She sentenced Noonan to 8 years in jail with the final year suspended. But then, 2 weeks later, you get word that Noonan had appealed the length of the sentence. And that's then what happened this week was that 22 months after that, his appeal, when that original sentence was handed down, the Court of Appeal upheld his sentence. So what have the last 22 months been like for you?
Pretty torturous, honestly. You know, I look back now and I see myself on the steps of the CCJ in July 2023 after he was sentenced. And I just look at her now and I say, oh my God, she has no idea it's not over. Because 2 weeks later, he puts in a sentence appeal, and you're put back into that justice process now. And you have to worry about the judges taking off 2 years, 3 years, who knows? And when someone goes to jail, you do start a countdown. So you have, for example, 5 years of him being behind bars where you can feel at peace.
Mm-hmm.
But the justice system took 2 years of that away from me. They took that peace from me. So I only started my peaceful, I suppose, living and the start of my healing journey on Monday, gone.
Yeah. So that 5 years, say, would have been the time for you to start doing that healing.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And to be ready then,
yeah,
to cope with it when that person's going to get out.
You can't heal when you have a case open.
Yeah. You said you felt he was controlling you from behind bars.
Yeah. Because, you know, it's the system that allows this to happen. And they're going to do whatever they can, because and the thing that annoys me the most is that he expressed remorse and he got time off for remorse. But when you put in a sentence appeal, you're really revoking that remorse.
Yeah. And that is the system as it's set up. Did he ever express remorse to you or say sorry to you?
He did, for his own benefit, and he got time off for it.
Okay. On Wednesday, the Justice Minister, Jim O'Callaghan, he did accept that the 22 months you waited was too long. Was that important here?
Yeah, yeah. I think to be acknowledged is almost like a golden ticket. It's the bare minimum, I know.
Yeah.
But it's a great thing to just at least be acknowledged. Yeah. Because you feel so... you know, voiceless. You feel like it's always landing on deaf ears. So that was a really, Jesus, thank God someone's actually listening to me.
Yeah. So powerlessness is a big part of all this for you. Yeah. So these days you're channeling your energy into a new organization you founded called Beyond Surviving. So tell me about Beyond Surviving.
So Beyond Surviving, I suppose what I noticed in myself and also from other survivors is that you really do progress, and it's such a great thing. And that's the whole point of it. You're supposed to progress on your journey. No one wants to live in crisis forever. And that's why the Rape Crisis Centres and Domestic Abuse Services are there. They help you in the trauma processing. They help you in the counselling. They help you to release the emotional weights of this trauma. And eventually you do progress on your journey. You're no longer in crisis. And then it suddenly feels like the services have ended. You don't feel like you fit in anymore. You don't feel like you are worth taking up their services anymore, because unfortunately there are so many victims who are still in crisis or just going into crisis now because this is an epidemic. So I noticed this gap and this need for services for survivors who feel like they're in limbo. They feel like they're not in crisis anymore, but they still want to meet other survivors and they still want healing support. They want support to reclaim their life. And what I've found is the service users of Beyond Surviving are actually a lot of women in their 60s, 70s, who are coming to Beyond Surviving because they've been healing on their own for 25, 30 years. This is the gap that I've addressed. And this I've almost felt like I have predicted my own future. And I hope that I won't be there in 25 plus years having healed in isolation. So this charity is also for me, but I'm really, really privileged and grateful to be able to support those survivors so that they don't feel so alone, because this is a lifelong journey and the services need to progress and grow with survivors. We need to acknowledge that it's going to be the rest of our life, but the services have to grow with us.
Okay, that's that really interesting. So when you got beyond crisis, say to where you're at now, what are the kind of effects that you still suffer from it?
Loneliness, that people don't truly understand the impact that this has had on your entire life. People often think that you eventually just get over it. You know, you feel like you're a broken record, that you're just harping on about the same thing that happened many years ago. So beyond surviving, you will never be a broken record. You're going to be with survivors who are also navigating similar waters to you. And you can talk about what happened to you for as long as you want with those who truly, truly understand, because they've been through it themselves. And there is really an untapped healing power in survivors coming together safely. Because before I set up Beyond Surviving, I was actually traveling around Ireland, meeting other survivors off Instagram, off text messages. And I actually didn't really know who I was going to be meeting. And it was quite risky because, you know, I could have been meeting someone who was pretending to be a survivor. So Beyond Surviving, we're a fully registered charity organisation. We have Garda vetting, all of that. So it's safe place for survivors to come together.
You said in that victim impact statement, in your innocence 2 years ago when you thought it was all over, but you said that you would not let this define who you are anymore. Where are you at in that journey?
I definitely feel like I have accepted what has happened. I have also accepted that this is going to be a part of my life forever, because we are serving life sentences. However, you do get to a stage, and I'm really blessed to be at the place now where my trauma is there, but it doesn't define me and it doesn't control every aspect of my life. I work with it and I work around it. I don't pretend that it's not there. I acknowledge it and I accept it, and I'm just, you know, excited almost to feel free of it, in a sense, where it doesn't control my life.
What is the alternative? Are there people for whom it defines the rest of their lives?
Support and family support is really, really important. A support network can really save you. It can define your... It can. I mean, I think we need support to rebuild our life and reclaim our life. And that's why, you know, healing support is important. And, you know, it takes a lot of work. Yeah. It can define your life, but it doesn't have to. And you need support and help to ensure that it doesn't.
And you're also running your own business as a trauma-informed coach now.
Yeah. Yeah. So I help people manage the impact that trauma has in their life today. So a counsellor or a therapist would really help, you know, process past traumas and process how, you know, the health effects of it and the emotional weights of it. Whereas a trauma-informed coach helps you to work with your trauma in a way where it doesn't define or determine what you can achieve. It helps you, you know, manage the way trauma is showing up in your life today. So for example, you may get, for example, public speaking or using my opinions or my voice is quite a trigger for me, because I know where that trauma stems from. And it's about managing that trauma, learning to feel safe, learning to know that that's not going to happen again, because your body and your mind and your soul remembers all of your experiences, be it positive or negative. Mm. So that's, you know, you need to learn to work with your nervous system and to teach it again that you're safe. So that's what I help survivors with.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you feel safe most of the time now?
I feel safe. I do. I feel safe. I feel like I can start to really heal now. I feel, I would say I feel free.
Yeah.
I feel free. It's like I just feel like my life is my own now. It's not being controlled by someone else. That's what really changed on Monday.
So since Monday is the first time you felt free?
Yeah. My life is literally my own now. No one is controlling my life from behind bars or through a prolonged justice process. This has been 12 years. You know, that's someone else impacting your life. That all got concluded on Monday. No one else is controlling me anymore. Just myself.
You're a remarkable woman and you're remarkably articulate. And I think so many people will find that so useful today and so clear and just, you know, can get the full picture. How are your family doing?
They're doing okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it impacts the entire family. We're all traumatized from this. If this happens to someone you love, if someone you love is treated like complete rubbish, it doesn't feel nice. I mean, that my mom and dad would always say, you're always going to be my baby. And it's, I'm not a mother, but I can imagine someone hurting your baby is really horrible. So although I've been through a lot, I can imagine that my parents have a lot of heartache.
Yeah, I'll bet. Ciara Mangan, thank you so much. And I'll just say to listeners, if you've been affected by any of the issues Ciara has raised, you'll find support at rte.ie/helplines. And Ciara, the web address for your organisation is beyondsurviving.ie, yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.